Hello and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. And Nicky Radio in Hertfordshire and our listeners in Swindon. And to our listeners at Verulam Radio in St Albans. Hello Radio Verulam. I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm James Melia. Come with me in the show.
By this time his business was very big. He had a mail, a hairdressing saloon. He made real wigs. Gradually had a ladies department upstairs. It was run by ladies for what ladies. And he had the most beautiful shop where he sold jewellery and leather goods. And he had the first agency of Elizabeth Arden.
An interview with Joan Rees, Ivor Gurney's cousin, recorded last year. She died this week. Ivor Gurney was the First World War poet and composer.
And basically what that means is when you go to the village, this is how they call the villagers to come out and join the dancing. So Futelema means come let's dance, yeah. So that's our popular song here, and it is popular in Africa as well.
A dance group from Bristol made it through to the finals of Got to Dance on Sky TV. We hear about African dance from one of the members of the dance team.
And later on, Jodie Farish, award-winning gardener, is back with us for some gardening tips. So we have with us Darren Jones, the prospective parliamentary candidate for Labour for Bristol North West. Hello, Darren. Welcome.
Hi. Good evening.
Nice to have you here. So it's an interesting state of affairs we have now, because I have quite a few friends under the age of 25 who can't see what the problem is with Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
How are you approaching that in your campaign up to 2015?
You're quite right. It's not a question of Thatcherism anymore. It's a question of Cameronism and what it means to have a coalition government. And I suppose the trouble is that increasingly there's a lot of people that don't see party politics as being important anymore, because I suppose ideologically there isn't the distinct differences that there were in the 60s, 70s and 80s. But actually, fundamentally, I think it comes down to a question of values and a position of perspective. And I passionately believe that the Labour Party is the only party that will govern with fairness and social justice and equality in mind. And seeing the impacts of this Conservative-led government as they do, that's why I think it's vital that Labour's return to government in 2015.
It's quite a big jump, joining the Labour Party and then deciding to stand for any position within it. How did that go about? How much support did you get?
Well, I suppose I've always had a bit of an innate energy in wanting to do things. Again, because of my background, I suppose, I've always ended up perhaps forcefully putting myself into positions where I might not necessarily have felt like I might have been welcomed. And that's carried through, really. So with party politics, you need to be empowered to make decisions, to have effects. So I knew early on that if I wanted to make a difference politically within a political party, you need to be a politician. To do that, you need to run for things. And so I just put myself out there, and the party's very supportive of people that want to be candidates. And so you get training and opportunities to stand in unwinnable seats, like I did in 2010 in Torridge in West Devon, and then they put you through training and support to be able to bring you to winnable seats.
Is there a pervasive attitude that you need to be in your 50s before you're effective? There are an awful lot of people that say to be an effective person you have to have had your own family, run your own business, commanded troops. I think that was the official line, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How does that feel within the party, and how do you feel about that personally?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think since Tony Blair, really, we've had quite a lot of young politicians. You know, I was in Beijing last summer with the Foreign Office, and you very much go through a rigorous process, and it's when you're in your older decades that you do take power. And they were completely bemused by the fact that we had prime ministers in our 40s, which is classed as being a young person over in China. I think actually the public mood is looking for more elderly statesmen, more experienced statesmen, mature statesmen, thank you, than younger ones. Now, that poses a dilemma for me, you know, being in my late 20s, as I will be when the 2015 general election comes along.
I was going to say, you do look quite young. I don't think you're fitting into the 40s at all there.
No, I think I need to grow a beard or something, I don't know. But having said that, I do think it's important that young people are involved in politics, because actually there's a lot of young people that have issues. And by young people, I mean young families as much as young people. And I don't think it's necessarily a question of age. I think it's a question of experience and ability to represent people and to stand up for, you know, hardworking families. And I think I can do those things.
Especially with the mooted idea that the voting age should be taken down to 16. So would you argue then that having younger representatives of all of the parties is a lot more relevant.
Absolutely correct. And I support the move to lower the voting age, because colleagues of mine in the Commons said in the debate last week, you can get married and have children and join the armed forces and buy lottery tickets and whatnot, you should be able to vote. And I think that's quite right. And government has said that they're not necessarily going to be supporting the bill that Stephen Williams and other Bristol MP put before the Commons. But if that were to happen, that's another argument to suggest that we need representation for them as much as we do for the rest of the country.
What job do you do outside of your political aspirations and motivations?
So I work for a law firm, so I work in legal services, advising businesses. Governments are increasing both domestically and internationally the amount of regulation. And so for businesses, the role of government and the role of managing regulation is increasingly important. And it's good to be able to have an understanding and an appreciation of the application of law before hopefully making it.
You mentioned that you were out in Beijing with the Foreign Office last year. Mm. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
Of course, yes. Yeah. So back in, I think it was 2009, David Miliband, as the Foreign Secretary, then signed an understanding with Beijing that we would work together to help our nations understand each other better, to work in better ways in the future. Clearly, China is dominating superpower and will increasingly be so in the future. And so for the United Kingdom, it's important that we have an understanding of how the country works for business as well as politics. And so part of that, they organised a number of exchanges between the UK and Britain for people that were identified as future leaders. And I don't know what the grounds were for that, but I was fortunate enough to be selected. I spent some time in Beijing in 2009. And then with the British Council last summer in 2012, I went back out to China just to further relationships with officials from the Chinese government. And as part of that, I was very pleased to organise the first official visit of the All China Youth Federation to Bristol, which I hosted, I think it was in November last year. And we have the Bristol China Partnership as well, that's doing a lot of work with China. And I think the relationship between Bristol and China, as well as the UK and China, is one that's going to be increasingly interesting.
How did that go? Because I can imagine there is two sides to a relationship with China, acknowledging the fact that it's the largest power in the world and it's the largest developing power in the world, but also the human rights record that they have.
Yeah, the whole communism thing. Yeah, no, I get that. No, I do understand. And it is a challenge. And
I'm just wondering how you managed to get away with having that in Bristol without a riot.
Well, yes. Well, maybe it's because the Evening Post didn't publish the press release. I don't know. But I think it's a balance, isn't it? And it's the international diplomatic piece. And foreign secretaries of today and gone have increasingly had to think about the approach to it. For the UK, it's important for business and the future role and ability for us to influence international politics, to have a relationship with China. But we also need to be brave enough to encourage them that actually things such as human rights and the freedom of their people to be able to exercise freedom of speech, for example, is one that we would rather they did. I think there's moves in China. It's really interesting, actually. It was a very different approach from 2009 to 2012. They were much more bullish, much more confident, but also Chinese young people that we were talking to in China seem much more empowered to be able to talk about the issues. But you can see trends beginning to develop and them moving towards that. So it'll be really interesting to watch.
Darren, thank you very much for joining us. So is there a website or an email address that we can get in contact with you?
Sure, yeah. If you just go to darren-jones.co.uk, all of my contact details are on there. I'd be very happy to have a chat with anyone that wants to get in touch.
Joan Rees, cousin of the First World War poet and composer Ivor Gurney, died in Fenchay Hospital this week. As a tribute to Joan, we're going to play her last interview in which she recalls her early life with her wealthy grandparents in Cardiff. First, some piano music by Ivor Gurney. Thank you.
My name is Joan Rees. I was born Joan Headley, and my grandmother was a Miss Gurney, hence I am related. Three removed, I'm a third cousin of Ivor Gurney.
Can you tell us your recollections of Ivor Gurney?
My recollections of Ivor Gurney are nil, because I was 14 when he died. I was staying with my grandparents. She had a message, and I said, "What's happened, Granny?" "Oh," she said, "it's terrible. We've heard Ivor's just died." It was Christmas Eve, 1937. And I said, "Who is Ivor?" "Well," she said, "Ivor is your third cousin. And he lived in Maysmore in Gloucestershire. And he was in a mental hospital and he died because he was a very sick man." And Grandma told me this, and I was 14 years old in 1937. She said, "When I was a girl, we all three boys played together. There was Ivor and his other cousins," and she said, "they're all dead now because all three of them were killed because of the First World War. Ivor died, and as I say, he was in France, where he should never have been," she said. "He was wounded once in the trenches. He wrote some of his poems and his music when the gunfire was going, and used to say, 'Run down, out the way, hide,' and then they'd come up again. Then he was shot, and he was sent back to England. He was wounded, and they repaired him, but in the meantime, he was in and out of mental hospital, and then he was sent back again. It was amazing to us as a family that he even survived. When he came back to Gloucester, he was sent to mental hospital in Barnwood. And of course, that was too close to his home. And when he was feeling better, he'd get out and run home again. And of course, the hospital never knew where he was. So eventually he was transferred down to Kent, and that is where he died. He couldn't run home from there.
Do you know anything else about the other members of the Gurney family?
Not really, because Grandma didn't talk about them very much. And you see, she hadn't seen them for some long time, because Grandma came. She married her husband, who was Robert Lane, who was from Tusson, which is in Herefordshire. And he had brothers and sisters by the dozen. There were 14 children, 7 boys and 7 girls. And Granny and Grandpa met in Gloucester. And then Grandpa, who was a hairdresser, decided he would open a business in Wales. There was a opening there, and he went to Cardiff. He had a wonderful shop opposite Cardiff Castle in Duke Street. He used to walk from Cardiff to Gloucester to see her on a Saturday afternoon. He walked there, and eventually, of course, he asked her to marry, and they came to Cardiff. They lived in various different places. Their final home was where I was when I heard, in a house called Tusson, and Tusson was the name of the village in Hereford where Grandpa was born, hence its name. It was a very beautiful house, very large house. It had its own tennis court. It had a beautiful garden. It had a full-size billiard room. Grandma and Grandpa particularly played billiards. In fact, he taught me to play. He told me I had to be very careful that I didn't break the wonderful green baize on the table. But they had very fine parties. They had two friends. The man was a baker, had a very big bakerage in Cardiff, and they used to come and play bridge. And they had foursomes, and I was allowed to sit on the stool and watch them play. And sometimes when the maid came in with coffee, she had to take me up to bed, because, of course, I was quite young. But I learned quite a bit about bridge, and I used to think, what a horrible game, arguments at the end. And the maid took me up to bed, and I had a beautiful bedroom at the back of the house that looked out onto the main road. It was called Kefin Coed Road. And a young doctor, two young doctors lived opposite. And when my mother was young, they all played together. And when I was 14, I wasn't very well. And a bit later on, when the war broke out, the one doctor was on Malta all the year. And he used to come home occasionally. And he often came home at Christmas. And for some reason, when I went there for Christmas holidays, I always seemed to be ill. And he came one day, he said, it's only because she's excited about Christmas. There's nothing the matter with her. She'll be all right. And so I always had a very happy Christmas. All the family gathered at Tusson for Christmas. My mother was the eldest of five of Granny and Grandpa's children. She was Florence. The next one was Dorothy. The third one was Lillian. The fourth one was Kay. And then they had a son, Bob. And then another daughter, Grace. And Uncle Bob was a wonderful man. Of course, he was my only uncle. And very sadly, he died very young too. He was 31. And he, when he finished at school, Grandpa sent him to Harrods to train as a businessman because he wanted Uncle Bob to take over his business. By this time, his business was very big. He had a mail, a hairdressing saloon. He made real wigs. Gradually had a ladies' department upstairs. It was run by ladies for all ladies. And he had the most beautiful shop where he sold jewellery and leather goods. And he had the first agency of Elizabeth Arden in Cardiff, because, of course, he sold cosmetics too. And he wanted Uncle Bob to take over. Uncle Bob did 3 years at Harrods. And he came home and he said to his father, "Father, I found businessmen poor. I do not want to work with them. I don't like their attitude." And Grandpa said, "Well, what do you want to do?" He said, "I'd like to go to Oxford," because he said, "I would like to become a priest." So he went to Keble College, Oxford, for 3 years. And then he went to theological college. And finally, he was a curate up in Armley in Leeds, a very poor part of Leeds. And he was there and lived in a house with the two Miss Johnsons. And the two Miss Johnsons looked after the clergy, because, of course, in those days, most of the curates weren't married. And on Christmas Eve, Uncle Bob had been out, and he didn't come in till fairly late. And one Miss Johnson, "Johnny," she said, "you go up to bed. I'll bring you a drink." So he said, "Oh, that'll be lovely." He said, "I can't get to my bed quick enough." 15 minutes or so later, she went up and opened the door. She came away because he was saying his prayers. She went back in again later, and he was still saying his prayers. He was dead. He died on Christmas Eve. He had suffered, when he was 18 or 19, scarlet fever. And in those days, scarlet fever, which was a streptococcal infection, sometimes left some people with a defect in their heart, and Uncle Bob was one. He had a coronary thrombosis.
That was Joan Rees, cousin of First World War poet and composer Ivor Gurney, talking to Anthea Page.
Our next studio guest is Jodie Farish.
Okay, Jodie, welcome to the show again. We're going to talk a bit today about gardening. What should people be trying to do around this time of year to prepare their gardens for the spring?
Well, you look outside and you think it is not the best weather to be going outdoors, but there's still plenty of jobs that can be getting done now and getting things ready for springtime. One of the things to be looking out for, there's a lot of apple trees around us, so pruning back apple and pear trees is a perfect job at this time of the year. As long as there's not a heavy frost in the morning, go out in a nice afternoon. It's one of my favourite jobs of the year, actually, is just pruning back apple and pear trees. And a lot of other fruits as well, like your red and black currants. You want to be taking those down, taking about a third of the growth out. So if you've got red currants or black currants in your garden, just find the old branches, the old stems, take them down to the base level and remove about one in three or four of the branches. So every 3 or 4 years you get a completely new shrub coming up. Keeps you nice and healthy and keeps you lots of fruit as well. And the same with raspberries. If you've got autumn fruiting raspberries that gave you some nice fruit last autumn, now's the time just to take them down to ground level. The new growth will start coming back up pretty soon, if not already. So it just makes way for the new growth to come through. As well as roses, this winter time is a good time to just trim those through so you've got a nice globe effect to it. So there's no crossing, no dead branches, no diseased branches. And start of spring, you'll start seeing some nice shoots coming out of those, and they recover very quickly. So you can be as harsh as you like, really, with a good rose, and a nice, healthy rose will come straight back up again. Winter's also a nice time for transplanting and planting in new trees and shrubs. So if you're thinking about putting in an apple tree or some shrubs into your garden, it's an ideal time of year to be doing that because they're dormant now. And just stick them in the ground, nice compost at the base, mulch around the top, and should take really well.
It's really a time for, you know, sort of cutting back on what was good in the previous year and making sure it's ready to bloom again come the spring.
That's right. Makes your garden look nice and neat as well. So all that old growth that's coming up, just to start taking that back down and getting everything to spring up into the spring. But there are other jobs to be doing around the garden as well, not just trimming things back. Just had the snow, unfortunately, but if we get any more, now's a great time to just make sure you knock it off your shrubs and your conifers so that it doesn't bend the branches. And sometimes the weight of the snow can snap those. You want to knock any snow off that's building up. And with warmer weather coming in spring, start warming the soil up in advance of spring by putting down some cloches, which are just traditionally would have been like a little glass tent, a little structure over the soil so that it just warms up from the sun on the sunnier days. You can go into a garden centre and pick up some nice plastic versions of cloches, which will warm the soil up, just give about another week or two's advance on planting seeds out.
And will that help avoid frost as well?
It can do, yes. If you've got delicate plants, put the cloches over the top and it just keeps that heavy frost off them. So it makes just a few degrees difference, but it definitely benefits the plants. And it's also a good time to be putting fertiliser onto things like your hedges and your shrubs, your roses and your fruit bushes. If you haven't done that already through the autumn into the winter, then you can still do that now. And over the next few weeks, it will start breaking down and getting into the soil. So just give a nice boost when they need the energy to get going for the new spring growth. And you can also be helping the wildlife as well. If you haven't got them up, maybe consider putting up some bird boxes into your garden. You can buy a variety of them from garden centres now, and in a few weeks' time the birds will be looking for places to nest, so it's good to get them up as early as possible. If you can get an open-fronted bird box, just put it within 2 metres of the ground in a nice denser part of the foliage in your garden somewhere. If you get one with a small hole in the front for blue tits, grey tits and things, then put it 2 to 4 metres up out of the sun, and things will start finding it as they're looking around for nest sites in the spring.
And I suppose now is the time of year as well. We should still be, you know, feeding the birds and leaving nuts and fat balls and things like that out for them as well.
Absolutely. It's really important with this cold weather. They really need it. And probably the most important thing as well, which people don't often do, is to make sure that they have fresh water and it doesn't freeze over. If it freezes, obviously it's no good to anybody. So you want to keep that fresh and melted. With your bird feeders, if you can keep them clean each time you fill them up, that's perfect, because at the moment there's a lot of birds coming to those. So if there is a disease in your area, it spreads very, very quickly. So you really just want to give it a wash and then put it back out with some more nuts and some flower hearts and fat balls in it. So.
And is there anything that you can be doing indoors to prepare your garden for thinking things like potting plants or preparing things in greenhouses, that kind of thing?
If you're lucky enough to have a greenhouse, absolutely. Cleaning it out for a start, if you haven't done that at the end of the season last year, start tidying up your seed trays, getting your compost in from the garden centres. You can even start with your seed trays to start sowing seeds into ready for the spring, because things like now, if you've got a greenhouse, you can be putting in lettuces, Brussels, cauliflowers, leeks and onions can all be getting sown into seeds, into seed trays in a greenhouse, and they'll be starting to come through just as the warm weather starts to hit in March time, end of March.
And what about potting plants? Is that something you should do in this time of year?
Yes, there's a whole range of things really that you could be starting to put into sowing the seeds to start them off for spring. And there's some nice bedding plants which will could start sowing the seeds. If you've got a greenhouse or somewhere a little bit warmer, you can start your geraniums, your begonias, lobelias and busy lizzies, which are really nice, just a lovely bit of colour through the nice early spring. Snapdragons and the lovely bright flowers, which I'm always amazed at when I see them. They just look really showy and almost too exotic for this country, the osteospermum, which just a lovely attractive flower for any garden. You can start that off sowing a seed in your greenhouse now. With spring coming now, you've got some real nice plants coming through with your daffodils and your crocuses and your bluebells especially will start looking really good. But there's also some other plants to look forward to, like your hellebores and your wood anemones. Again, with the bluebells, they're all very shade tolerant as well, so it brightens up that nice shady area of your garden, which quite often people struggle to get a bit of colour into. You've got the lovely yellow forsythias about to burst into colour, and the magnolia trees as well. The stellata especially is a spectacular tree. It's such a small garden tree that it's almost shrub-sized for a lot of people. And if you've got a small garden, magnolia stellata is one I'd really recommend for an early bit of colour. And with the early colour and the early flowers, it's important to get that out because you've got the butterflies and the bees that come out early on warmer days in very early spring. They get woken up by the warmth. They come out and it's really important that there's the pollen and the nectar for them to feed on, because they've been going through a whole winter without anything to eat so far. Without the early flowering varieties of plants, they really struggle. So it is important to put those out.
So when should you be looking at transferring plants into the garden?
I would definitely wait till the very last frosts have gone. It's all very tempting when you get a nice warm weekend in early March to rush to your garden centre, which will be full of plants. They're all very tempting to buy, but unless you've got somewhere to keep them a little bit sheltered, I'd be a bit reluctant to buy them very early in March, because there's still a chance of heavy frost and anything that you buy may well just disappear into the frost. So once the frosts have disappeared, your garden's warming up towards the end of March, early April, you can go to the garden centre and there'll be lots of bedding plants that you can start getting in with a lot of colour, primulas and cowslips and things like that. Just putting those in. You can even buy bulbs in the pot, and then once they've gone over, start putting those in your garden and they'll come up for many years to come.
And you have a website, I believe, Jodie.
If people want to find out more information on gardening, and there's some top tips for making your garden look nice, and also advice on what to do now in your garden, and they can find that at www.jodysgardenservices.co.uk, and that's Jodie, J-O-D-Y.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you once again, Jodie.
Great, thank you.
A feature now about water polo. David Williams tells us about the difference between social water polo and competitive water polo.
Water polo, that sounds very exciting. Is it a part of a broader initiative of swimming, or is it something you just love?
I do just love it, yeah. I was introduced to it at college, actually, having been a competitive and serious swimmer for a long time. Met my wife in a water polo swimming club in Manchester.
So how professional was your swimming when it got to its height?
Not a very high level, but club level. Okay. I've been club level for a long time, and still am. We do masters.
Do you want to describe what masters mean?
What normally happens with club swimming, if you're competing or you're training at club level, when you get to 25, you're classed as past it in terms of general club senior squad level. And there's a worldwide category called Masters Swimming, where you have five-year groups. So that there's not really the equivalent of Masters Swimming in water polo. With water polo, it's such a minority sport in the UK that once you've got to the past it level, that's to say if you're in a club playing in a league and you get older, there's nowhere really you can go except to drop out. That's how I see it. That's not to say a lot of clubs haven't got people in who are in their 40s, 50s and even 60s who do still play and make a contribution, but I find generally that once you've got a family, you can't really commit to three or four times a week training, or even twice a week training, and all the matches, then you can't really fit into a league team. Which leads me to my philosophy, which is that adults should still have access to these kinds of sports. So it led us to set up a club for older people to play water polo in a social environment rather than a highly competitive environment.
Would you describe what water polo is? I think there's still quite a few people that don't understand what it means.
Yeah, sure. It's a lot like basketball, where you have a small number of people in the pool, which is the pitch, and you have a goal at each end, and you have to get the ball from your end up to the other and score it in a goal. It's a game of possession like basketball, so you try and hold on to the ball as long as you can, within reason, and pass it around, and the team all swim up and attack, and you all rush back to defend, just like in basketball. It's not quite the same as in football, where people tend to hang in positions throughout the game. It's a very fast game. It's nothing more, really, to view than a game where you're trying to score goals.
So the ball is kept out of the water?
Yeah, it's always got to be above the water, and you can only use one hand, which makes it difficult. And, of course, it's played in deep water, so you've got to be treading water and moving all the time. You're not supposed to stand on the bottom or bounce off the bottom or off the sides. It's quite physically demanding.
And how do you score a goal?
Well, you literally just pass the ball up the pitch. The pitches are normally 20 or 25 metres long, so, you know, the length of an ordinary swimming pool, and you just pass it around until you get near the goal and you've got a good shot and there's a goalkeeper, and you just score into the net. Or you can swim it into the net, but mostly it's just a shot. The net's above the waterline.
Okay, and what kind of ball gets used?
There's a special kind of water polo ball. There's a different size for men and women. There's a size 5 for men and a size 4 for women, which makes it a little bit difficult for us, as we've got a mixed team. You see, that's very important, that our club and our teams are mixed. So we tend to use a size 4 ball. Both the balls, they're normally yellow for visibility, and they've got the kind of tack, the sticky kind of surface, so that you can plant your hand on the top of it while it's in the water and raise it above your head all in one movement, so you don't need the two hands.
Are they quite heavy?
They're much lighter than the football, much lighter than the basketball.
So your club that you've set up, what's it called?
Bristol Hengrove Masters. Our club is swimming and water polo, but we're swimming and social water polo. So our water polo side don't have a league team. We just have a social water polo section.
And does that mean you'd get two teams together, or do you have matches?
Well, no. Unfortunately, at the moment, we don't know of any other groups like us. That's not a problem, but it's something that we'd like to deal with in the future. At the moment, we're quite happy to build it nicely. Every session we have, we've got new people coming to. We normally do a training workout, ball skills, and then a match between ourselves for at least half an hour. So everyone gets experience of playing in a mixed game. Ours is a lot more relaxed than the fully competitive game, which can be slightly aggressive. At the moment, we don't know of any other clubs in the country that are mixed or that play in a more social or relaxed way.
So health levels, what do you expect from someone that wants to come along and play water polo with you?
Well, we've got written down standards. It says you need to be able to swim as little as 50 metres front crawl continuously, and you need to be able to tread water for 3 or 4 minutes continuously. When you're actually in a match, you tread water for a bit, you swim around, you tread water. So it's not treading water for all that time. So you're swimming up, you tread water for a bit, receive a pass, pass it on, bit of swimming, swim back, defend, swim up again. Anyone who's a lane swimmer, I'd say, who can do a lot of front crawl and is okay swimming in the lanes, would be fine physically. It's a fast-moving game, but it's always changing. An important thing I should state is, if you compare it to football, it's a lot shorter. So we play two halves or four quarters that are only 7 or 8 minutes long. It's very intensive, but it's nothing like the 90 minutes that you play in a football game. Polo, you can't wear goggles, you can't wear any kind of eye protection, so you do start to feel the effect of chlorine after about half an hour or 45 minutes.
And is there anything else you need to wear for it?
Well, yeah, there is. We supply hats. If you play water polo in a match, you need a system whereby you can see who's on your side and who you're playing against. So there are special hats, and these hats are either blue or white, and they have ear defenders. They're funny-looking things, but they're tied under the chin, and they're also numbered as well.
Sounds like it could be an awful lot of fun.
It's a real fun game. It's very addictive. With me, and as soon as I was introduced to it, I just wanted to play it every day. It's a really good game. It's playing indoors. You know, there's nothing like going out on a cold pitch. As I say, we play it in a more relaxed way, in a social way, so it's not full contact. You block and you get in the way of people, but you don't climb all over people. There's pressure to pass the ball around, but it's not aggressive or nasty or rough. It's really good fun. It's continuous substitutions as well, so you normally have at least 3 or 4 people on the pool side, so when you're feeling like you've worn out after few sprints, you put your hand up and you get substituted. That's how it works.
So you mentioned the fact that the competitive games differ slightly to the way that your group play. How does it differ?
Well, this is the problem with water polo. It's that it has got a bad name, I'm afraid. If you go on YouTube and you put in water polo, you're more likely than anything else to get up videos and shots of people's trunks being ripped off, people getting poked in the eye, things like this. It is known to be quite a rough game. I don't think it's as tough as football, for example, but it is a rough game because it's full contact. And in league polo, single sex, you're allowed to climb all over somebody who's got the ball. We eliminate that, and we've taken a model invented by a New Zealand club, which is Social Water Polo League. In our game, because it's mixed, it's non-contact.
And is it mixed sex as well?
We fix it so that there's always got to be some male and female players in the water together. So although it's continuously substituted, there's always got to be some male and female on each side. If you go down the road and look for a water polo club, you're almost certainly going to find one that would expect you to have played for a long time, be able to commit to all of the matches and all the training. And a lot of the matches are away games. It's really difficult to commit to that level. And you've got to be good. Because clubs are in leagues, they haven't really got time to train people up. I know it sounds strange. You've got to learn somewhere, but they expect you to have learned at school or college. With our system, you can just drop in. If you can swim and tread water, then you can come and join in. For the first few sessions, you'll be holding the ball with two hands because it does take a little while to get the one hand thing, but that's a bit of flexibility. We welcome all beginners and new players, and there's no pressure at all. It's just a game to have fun. We want it to be like going down the park and playing softball or football in the summer. Just like that, you can just drop into one of our sessions in the pool and play water polo, and it's very social.
Excellent. So if we wanted to find out more, where should we go, Dan?
Our website is bristolmasters.co.uk. We've also got a Twitter, which is Bristol Masters, and we'd welcome anyone to just come along and try us anytime.
Excellent, thank you very much.
That was Kirsty Paul in an interview with David Williams on social water polo.
A Bristol African dance team got through to the finals of Sky TV's Got to Dance, so let's hear all about it from Alan Roberts, artistic director of the independently owned dance centre in Bristol. To introduce the feature, some music from Where Else But Africa.
Welcome to the Dance Centre. We're all very excited tonight because we just heard the news that one of the groups, Mundi Dance, who've been making work in African dance with Louis Roger, he's one of our freelance associate artists here, and they've got through to the film stages of Got to Dance on Sky TV. So everyone's jumping for joy here, and it's very exciting that a group that come to open access public classes just 1 hour a week and then rehearse here for another 1 hour have actually made it all the way through to the film stages of Got to Dance. It's very good news for Bristol, and it's fantastic that there are 17 associate artists here working in everything from breakdance to Bhangra to Bollywood to African to contemporary dance, flamenco. Forget the internet. We've got an internet of physical knowledge here at the Dance Centre. We're enjoying the busiest art in our history as well. People come, as you can see tonight with the numbers coming in, people are coming through the cold and the snow because they've got to dance.
Tell us about your campaign.
Well, it's like everything. We're housed in a beautiful former Victorian swimming pool, which now needs a new roof. So we're just in the planning stage. It's going to be for $500,000, and that will buy us a new glass roof, and we're hoping to incorporate solar panels within that. So the idea is, we've got something like a £12,000 a year carbon footprint in the gas and electricity we burn. So it would be like having a grant for that amount if we can replace it with photovoltaic panels and harvest it from the sun. We'll have a form of funding for as long as the sun shines. That's the idea.
So the idea is for 250,000 people to just give £10.
Now I'm getting my calculator. Yes, just give £10. This is the longest running dance dedicated organisation in the UK. We're celebrating 35 years. And during that time, we've worked with artists from literally all around the world. We have 1,000 people a week dance here every week. It's an amazing base, and you never know who's walking in through the doors here. But we've worked with a great many people, so it's a very simple campaign, really.
Well, I've been here, half an hour, and it's very international, isn't it? Because dance crosses all boundaries, and you've got people coming from all over the world to meet other people.
Well, dance is a force for social cohesion. That's a good quote, isn't it? But it does bring people together. It's a non-verbal form of communication, as you've said, so it transcends language and those kind of barriers, really.
So what's your email in case someone's desperate to give you that £10, which they can easily afford?
Okay, it's bristoldance@btconnect.com. And what we're planning on having is a wall of fame. We're going to have a perspex wall with people's names that have contributed. I mean, it's a real crossroad. There's only so long you can operate sort of patching roofs. It's 135 years old now, and it just needs replacing.
I'm actually in the large studio at the Dance Centre. Excuse me, can I just ask you what you're doing tonight?
Zumba, I think, but I've never done it before, so this is my first try.
Are you nervous?
No, I'll be all right.
Say something about Zumba. This is my third week at Zumba, and it's a revelation. I thought I could enjoy exercise.
Is it enormous young men doing Zumba?
This is my first time. I've never been before, so I haven't a clue. Really?
You look a bit worried.
Well, I have no idea what to expect, really, other than it. I have to make sure I don't mind looking like a bit of an idiot, but that's fine.
What about you? Come along to support your friend.
I've been 3 times with my friends. And yeah, it's really good fun, actually. As long as you're willing to look a bit silly and just, you know, get into it, it's good fun. Good exercise.
It's not like rowing, is it?
Not quite like rowing, no. They're quite different. Yeah, more rhythm and more skill, I think. Rowing's just brute force.
Hello.
I'm here with Will. You do breakdancing. Hi. Tell us about breakdancing. What kind of people does it attract?
Young people. A lot of people sort of, you know, see it in the streets and they'll be like, oh, that's amazing, see it on TV and want to get involved. But yeah, I mean, all ages, really. I teach a class and I've got 35, 40-year-olds, whatever. Breakdancing is a term which is mainly used by the media, but I call it b-boying. That's what it's sort of, the culture is b-boying. Yeah.
Where did it originate from?
Originally came from the Bronx in New York in like 1980s, 1970s. Came from like social dances and like the clubs in sort of the Bronx and the streets. Yeah, and people had sort of nothing else to do, and they b-boy stands for like break boy. So that's when in the music, what happened in hip-hop was there was a break, which meant like just the drum part. And that's when the b-boys used to get down in the clubs and they used to hit the floor, and famous, yeah, Rocksteady Crew from New York, they sort of pioneered it from there, and yeah.
You're quite young to be a tutor. How did you get into it?
Well, actually, I came here first in the Bristol Dance Centre. My first lesson was here when I was 8, I sort of stopped for a bit, but I've been doing it consistently for about 4 years. This is my fifth year now, and I've just recently taken over from my teacher to teach here. And yeah.
Do you think it keeps young people off the streets, gives them something to do?
Definitely, I definitely reckon it does. I mean, there has been experiences where people, it literally has changed their lives and like got them out of poverty, like even places like the Philippines, places like that, like sort of kids that would have gone into like, I don't know, street crime or something like that. Like it's definitely a thing that has a, like it's either do this or go into that kind of scene, which is really good, like, and people have chosen this path.
Would you say that, unlike a lot of dances, it actually attracts more young men than women?
The dance is generally male based. It's not, there are females definitely, and it does attract, yeah, females. I think there is like a very competitive vibe about it.
Is it a set dance, or can people invent their own steps within it?
Definitely. I mean, there's a foundation which everyone should learn. There's the top rock footwork elements, and it's like the power, which is like more like gymnastic. That's how people see it, like flares and things like that. That's like sort of foundation of breaking. And then as you sort of develop, you get into your own style, and people create their own moves and their own way of doing things, which is really like what it is all about, originality and being you and having your own flavour on this sort of genre that we call b-boy.
Tell us about your fantastic news, Sky.
You caught me by surprise there. Basically what it is we were invited to London to audition for the Got to Dance TV show. And we actually got 3 gold stars, so that was really good. And that's the best news we could ever hope for, to be honest.
Are you the only male dancer in the group?
Oh, no, it's myself and Louis. Louis is actually the choreographer. But yeah, there's only 2 male dancers and 5 female, yeah.
Do you have any roots in Cameroon?
Ooh, I'm from Africa originally. Born in Sierra Leone, grew up in Ghana, but Louis is from Cameroon. He sort of started dancing in Cameroon, but I joined him over here and then built the group from scratch, yeah.
Do you recognise any of the dances in Ghana?
Yes, every move has a meaning. The moves, you just know what it means and just how much it means sort of for that move to come from that part of Africa. Yeah, so it's really an exciting time for us.
The dancing, it's very much to do with your roots, isn't it? The soil, the earth.
Yeah.
It's very organic dance.
Indeed.
And very vigorous.
Indeed.
What age do young children start dancing in Africa?
As early as possible. Every evening, if you go to the villages, for example, dancing is a way of sort of expressing their happiness, even sadness, to be honest. Funerals, weddings, birthday parties. So every evening, there is drumming and dancing in Africa. Yeah, and the children are always involved, singing and dancing. Yeah.
What's the most popular song?
Ooh. There's so many different songs, but the one we sang on TV, I can sing that briefly for you. It goes, Futele mai, landa futele mai. And basically what that means is when you go to the village, this is how they call the villagers to come out and join the dancing. So Futele mai means come let's dance, yeah. So that's our popular song here. And it is popular in Africa as well.
Tell us about the kind of costumes you would wear in Africa.
Again, it depends on the kind of dancing we were doing. Like what we did on Sky was we went as contemporary African dancers. So the costumes were like skirty type. Have you ever seen the Zulu dancers? In Africa, we would use the like antelope skin, etc. But here, because we don't have it, we sort of compromise and use other fabrics. But yeah, it has to look like animal skin, etc. Yeah, because we use it for hunting, you see.
What about the drums? What kind of drums are those that you use?
All kinds of drums, from djembe to conga to another drum called the dundum. Basically, that's the bass. And
it sounds like the bass.
Yeah, we renamed it the dundum. And yeah, it's a combination of all these drums. It galvanizes, as you see. So the louder you play, the better. And yeah, it's incredible. You should see us dancing. It's really amazing. Yeah.
That was Anthea Page at the independently owned Dance Centre in Bristol.
A poem now, read by Linda Paul in Hertfordshire.
Main Talk by Liz Lockhead. Women, rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. Women, tattle and titter. Women prattle, women waffle and witter, men talk, men talk. Women into girl talk about women's troubles, trivia and small talk. They yap and they babble, men talk, men talk. Women yatter, women chatter, women show the fat, women spill the beans. Women ain't been taking the oh so good advice in them's women's magazines. A man likes a good listener, oh yeah. I like a woman who likes me enough not to nitpick, not to nag, and not to interrupt, because I should call that treason. A woman with good grace to be struck dumb by me, sweet reason, yes. A man likes a good listener. A real man likes a real good listener. Women yap, yap, yap. Verbal diarrhea is a female disease. Women, she spreads the rumours round she like Philadelphia cream cheese. Oh, bossy women gossip, girlish women giggle, women natter, women nag, women niggle, 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 men talk. Men, think first, speak later, men talk.
Thanks, Linda. Over to Tim Burrows.
Thanks, Tim.
That's all from Backchat this week. Features were by Anthea Page and Kirsty Paul. Editors, Anthea Page and Kirsty Paul. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. Producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And it's goodbye from me, James Melia. Until next week, goodbye.